So, after
a long time,
after what seems like a long time of sharing pictures about this podcast, finally, this thing that you've been seeing on social media for ages is actually happening. This is episode one of Unpaved.
Hey, we're finally here.
Catherine, what is Unpaved?
Unpaved is Unpaved is Unpaved is. I think Unpaved is our way of taking you on a bike ride with us.
Yeah.
And a real good excuse to chat to really interesting people in the sort of off-road, gravel, adventure cycling, bike packing world. And we want to make sure that with each episode, there's a really cool route that we've created with those local hosts so that you can pick it up and you can go and ride it. So they're all going to be available on our Komoot account. If you're not familiar with Komoot, it's a route planning and navigation app that really puts experience at the forefront, so you can use it to plan for mountain biking or gravel riding or road, and there's different algorithms that help you, so it's really, really handy for that. So today's ride is from the Wood Cyclery, which is an adventure cycling shop right at the heart of the New Forest, and as we arrived we found about 50 people milling about half of them inside and half spilling out onto the pavement, all eating sticky cinnamon buns and drinking coffee, so we better get on in there.
Hello.
John, we got any more mugs?
Let's go and say hello to Tom.
Tom Farrell is one of the co-owners of the Wood Cyclery, and he organises free weekly gravel rides from the shop here in Lyndhurst, right at the heart of the New Forest.
It's gone nuts. Like, we used to regularly get 10, maybe 15 people, but the last three rides we've done, 37 people turned up to one. The next one was about 25 people. Yeah, man, looks like a good turnout today, despite the crap weather.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Will. How you doing?
This is Will Mayer, co-founder of Brother Cycles, with his brother, James. They've run a mini off-road cycling festival called Brother in the Wild in the New Forest for the last few years, and this year it's going to be in nearby Purbeck.
The ride in here today was so nice. I mean, like, literally just down the road for 5 minutes or something, but it's like, this may lead us into a kind of like false sense of security, and it's going to pour with rain a bit later.
So we wanted to visit Tom and Will because in this first episode we really want to explore how we got to where we are now. Whether this sort of gravel, bikepacking, adventure cycling stuff is all new or what it's evolved from. And I think these guys are really well placed to help us understand that. And also, we've got 50 riders here today. How have they achieved that and what's led to that? So that's really what we're going to be exploring in today's podcast.
All right, guys, we're going to go over the road up to Pikes Hill, and then as soon as we can get onto some gravel, we're going to do a nice big climb up to the War Memorial, do a big loop around to Milcombe Enclosure, back around. It's about 23 miles, a little bit of climbing, probably 15 to 20 punches, I would imagine. We'll see how it goes.
I really love this squeaky brakes at the start. It sounds
it's
a bit like
morning. Yeah. Squeaky brake reciting.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
How I feel
it's
as
like
well,
the clowns are going through town or something.
I mean, it's pretty awesome.
You're welcome.
Too. Like when I came out of the shop, I was like, oh my god, there's so many more people there. I'm Cece. We were down in the New Forest for a bit of an adventure this weekend anyway, and just thought it would be nice to come and see some other like-minded people, basically, and see what the New Forest has to offer. It was nice because it was super flat. Like, where we're from, it's nice off-road, but it's really hilly, so actually, yeah, it was amazing to actually cruise on real gravel as opposed to just mud. And it's pretty empty, it's pretty deserted, and there's nice horses to look at as well. It's pretty good. So yeah, we were walking to Denny last night and there was just a horse walking down the pavement. It's amazing. I love that every house has to have a cattle grid just to keep the horses out. And yeah, it's great so far.
This is like mountain biking in the early 90s, all over again, which kind of suits me. This is reinventing my early 20s, which is great for someone who's approaching their 50th birthday. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, I thought we'd lost
you. I thought we'd lost you for a minute.
So how's the ride going?
Power
Amazing!
It's really nice in the New Forest. There's obviously a massive appetite for this kind of riding. And I think this time of year as well, they're blessed with these
sort of golden, stony, rocky double tracks, which is kind of like riding at a mountain bike trail centre where you know it's going to be like a really good and well-maintained surface where it's not just slop, which I think is a good way of describing conditions in a lot of other parts of the UK at the moment. So you can go for a really good gravel ride without looking like you've just sort of waded through a bog, which is quite nice. And okay, they're not endless, but they do go on for a long time, which is fairly, I won't say unique, but it's unusual, especially for this part of the country. If you head to mid Wales and Scotland, you'll find a lot of it, a lot in the north. But in terms of the south of England, it's pretty special. We're just passing a pony as well, which is super nice. They get all the wild, well, semi-wild New Forest ponies around here. Lots of donkeys and free-roaming cattle. Just really different, it's nice.
I just immediately feel like I'm on holiday.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're in here, you're miles away from cars, you're in the woods, it's calm, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I started riding, like, road touring in southwestern Ontario on vintage bikes. And then I moved to the UK and was still riding the road. And then I went back to Canada for a summer and rode a ride called the Colt, which is the Central Ontario Loop Trail Colt. And it's a 400 kilometer off-road loop in Ontario. It's like the roughest thing I had ever ridden in my life. And that was probably the first time I ever rode something that had disc brakes. I rode a Velo Orange Polyvalence from a friend's local bike shop, sort of to test out. It wasn't mine. It was the first time I had ever ridden, like, they were like 2.25 inch tires, and I needed them. It was like sand and puddles and stuff I had never ridden in my entire life, but I loved it. And then probably the next thing I did was Brother in the Wild Bordeaux. That was probably the next time I rode something like that even like resembled mountain biking a little bit. And then I was like, oh, I never want to ride on the road again.
You rode Bordeaux single speed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I hear the guys who run that pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know who you're talking about. I don't know, I just heard that.
So yeah, the guys that ran that.
Oh yeah.
I don't know where they are now, but
they started that off around here. So you started Brother in the Wild here. What was your kind of affinity to the place? Did you know it well already?
No, not really actually. I am, as is the case, like we just launched a new product, which is the Kepler at the time, which is like a kind of gravel touring steel frame bike. And that was as my own interest, and it was all growing. And I literally was just looking at places near London. I lived in London at the time, of like, where can I go and just like ride some gravel in one day and get on a train there and back. And I saw the New Forest. I came down and like I had a day of riding here. I actually ended up booking into like a little bed and breakfast. Oh, someone's falling over. I was just blown away by how amazing the riding was, how wild it felt, how close it was to London. And that's why I was like, we have to organise an event. We have to show more people this. Because like, and we were like, let's organise a free event and hire a farmer's field and people can just turn up and camp and ride. And yeah, that's how it all started.
Part of it also seemed like you encapsulated a feeling of lots of people that were getting into it but didn't necessarily have like a thing that they could all do together that wasn't an event.
Yeah. And I guess because traditionally it's been not underground, but like a very small culture that's grown.
Yeah,
I think finding other people from all over the country and beyond that are on the same wavelength as you are, it's amazing. And it's just facilitating that people coming together.
Yeah, and like when we were first starting out, I always had friends messaging me being like, oh, like, let's organise a trip, or like, can we come on one of your next trips? Like, what have you... Everyone was so keen to do something. you know, people who got into cycling through, you know, it being a good form of transport, and then kind of enjoying it, and then group kind of fixed gear rides, and maybe riding to Brighton fixed gear and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it just seemed like a natural. I mean, the first year it was literally a farmer's field. It was covered in cows the week before we had the event there, and it was free. We had like some coffee on site and a bit of food, but it was just, don't expect much. It's free. You have to sign up, but just turn up. Here's a route. Have fun. And like, it was amazing. We had like over 100 people sign up in like super quick, like under a week. The whole place was filled, and it was just a real sign for us at the time. It was like, there's like a lot of people who are really kind of into it. And what was cool is like a lot of people there we'd met, like you say, through Panier events or through fixed gear things in London. But there's also just a big group of people who came completely alone. They didn't really know anyone else who wanted to do this kind of cycling, but they were just itching to get out on a little adventure. And yeah, it just seems like that is now just growing and growing. And, you know, well, look at this event now. We've got like 50 people here, kind of.
All riding away from us as we chat.
Yeah, I know. I think everyone has these realizations like, why are we waiting for those guys to speak into the microphone? Keep riding.
Tan line on your shorts where you've had them folded up.
Oh, yeah.
And then obviously ridden them loads in the summer. Yeah. And then rolled them back down again for that extra inch of winter warmth.
Inch of warmth on my thighs. You know, cover up your the exposed bits. Well, you should come to Brother in the Wild this year.
We're planning on it.
Cool.
Yeah, we're keen.
Yeah, I mean, it's super chilled. You know, like we still, you know, the routes are a bit more technical now. We're in the Burbex. New Forest is so good for riding, but it's not limited, but like there are certain areas you ride in, and once you've done it 3 years in a row, we figured it's good to freshen it up a little bit. And the venue we've got in the Purbex is like we had no cover in the New Forest. So one year we had like this crazy electrical thunderstorm roll through, and the whole field was like a foot underwater within about a minute of it raining. And like, so we figured we should get somewhere a little bit more better set up. And then this year,
abroad.
Yeah, we've got we actually had a few shops, like kind of almost jokingly, shops being like, oh, Brother in the Wild looks so cool, we should do one like over here in Germany or in France. And
yeah,
and actually, so now we've done, last year we had Berlin, Munich and Bordeaux.
That's incredible.
It's so cool, man.
Did you get like the same reception over there?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like the German gravel scene is massive.
Yeah,
like they've just got amazing riding over there, and it's so cool to like collaborate with shops that we work with, and we meet a whole different kind of crew of clientele, but you know, like it's all pretty much the same. It's like people into exactly the same thing and riding in the same way. And
I guess it's really great for those people to see one of the brothers or two of the brothers behind the brand
and
get to know a bit more about what you're about.
Yeah, hopefully we're not too much of a letdown when they meet us.
This guy couldn't possibly buy one of his bikes.
You're who? What?
Tom? There's two flats back that way.
How far back do you think it is?
They've got the route.
Okay. Well, let's hang here for a little bit and see if they can catch up. The chances are we'll have one about a mile down there, and then they'll catch up with us. So that's how it normally goes.
So do you tend to lead these rides?
I do, yeah. I love taking photos, so I always get the shots. And it often shoots me in the foot, because I've had moments where I'm trying to take a picture with no hands on the handlebars and nearly gone over. In fact, I have gone over before, in front of everyone.
And when you've got this many people coming, it must be really good for the shop as well.
It's amazing. I mean, everyone buys coffee, buns, you know, people pick up gloves and little bits. And I like to think that people will just think of us next time they need a new bike, which it does happen. They come on a ride, even if they don't live near us, they'll travel to buy the next bike from us because they've got a bit of a social connection with us. Which, yeah, that's what bike shops need these days. I think bike shops that are not doing anything social at all are competing with online, and that's always going to be a struggle. But yeah, as long as you can serve them coffee, get something to get them in the door, and it all helps. But yeah.
And you started at a time where bike shops were really not doing so well, or a lot of bike shops are really suffering with
competition from online, etc. What made you set up Woods?
That's a good question. Well, we have another bike shop, which is mainly a hire centre. So it's a smaller shop. It's always been a struggle to sell high-level bikes from there because it's seen as a hire centre. So that's always been a good business. And me and John, my business partner, we took over that shop. And at the same time, the premises we're in at the Woods came up for rent. And we just looked at that and thought, that is such a good spot. And we just went for it. And I think, like, I was getting into gravel at the same time, and I knew it was going to blow up. Like, there was no question about the popularity increasing. So, yeah, we just went for it.
Why was it blowing up?
That's a good question. I think, like, roads are getting busier. I think people aspired to ride on the road and be quick and race each other, and lots of average cyclists realised, like, what's the point in racing? Like, what is much nicer to just go out at a gentle pace and explore. I think the whole adventure kind of thing happened at the same time, whether it's hiking, camping, it all went hand in hand with gravel riding and bikepacking. It all worked kind of in sequence.
Do you find from people coming in the shop maybe wanting to get into gravel for the first time, they come from different routes, or do you find most people are road cyclists or most people are mountain bikers?
Definitely all different routes, and that's, I think, the best thing about it is it appeals to everyone. I come from a BMX background, and after destroying my knee, I couldn't really ride BMX anymore. I started riding track bikes, and I think I kind of like the aesthetic of a ratty track bike coming from BMX, single speed, really simple. So I started doing that to rehab my knee. And then got into mountain biking a little bit because I used to mountain bike when I was a kid, and then got bored of riding track and riding on the road, and mountain biking, BMX and track all together kind of is gravel, isn't it, in a way? And then there's road riders that are now starting to get into gravel, and they're the ones that we're selling really nice, fancy, expensive bikes to, because they don't mind spending loads of money. They're used to, you know, the road market, you can spend $5,000 plus on a bike. And so there's a whole different scene. There's like the steel frame, homegrown, ex-BMXer, ex-track rider that's knocking up a bike in their shed. And then there's the high-level road rider that's spending a fortune on a nice carbon gravel bike. And yeah, there's so many different sides to it. Because there's the racing side, you know, gravel races are getting huge now, which is cool. But it's totally different to the sort of exploring, camping side of it as well. Yeah, something for everyone.
Will, I wanted to ask you about this. Yeah. Tom was just talking about road riders that have moved over into the gravel scene.
Yeah, yeah.
So with you released the Kepler.
Yep.
Like, solid kind of do-it-all bike there, which loads of people love. But then more recently, you've started bringing out bikes with different tubing and that sort of stuff. Is that partly to do with this kind of change in gravel with more people?
It's actually stemmed from a conversation with Tom a couple of years back, where, you know, we're really close to all the shops we work with, and they often talk to us a lot about what they like about our product, what they're looking for, and like some of the feedback, Tom was the same, just saying people love the Kepler, but they just want to spend a bit more money. Like they like gravel riding, and they want something a bit lighter, they want some better components, they want, you know, some nice hydraulic brakes on it, and the Kepler's a great frame. I've been riding one for years, but like it's solid, it's do it all. So the Mate was kind of our take on a slightly higher end, kind of slightly more technical, you know, it's better tubing, it's slightly more lightweight, it's,
bigger,
it's
got tires.
Yeah, bigger clearances.
Bigger tires.
Exactly. Yeah. So, our products are all quite kind of solid, and we don't really, we want one bike to be able to perform lots of different functions, but we're doing stuff slightly more kind of focused on the gravel scene at the moment.
And I think it's worth picking up on what Tom said, in that there is a huge amount, even within gravel, if you want to call it that, adventure cycling, there's a huge range. It's like mountain biking now is everything from downhill to cross country to trail and everything in between. And it's the same with gravel. You get people who want to go bike packing for 2 months and carry everything on your bike. And then there's other people who just want to go like really fast and do some of these gravel enduros or long distance races.
And like, you can be a mountain biker that wants to go slightly longer distance, or you can be like a cyclocross racer who wants to do something a bit more chilled, or you can be a commuter who wants a bike that can go on. Do you know what I mean? The gravel thing can kind of like, you can come at it from so many different angles.
Yeah, and it's not really a new thing, because you think about people who've been riding cyclocross bikes on gravel for years, and they tend to be quite uncomfortable and race orientated. and then there's traditional touring. You know, most touring rides will end up riding on some kind of off-road.
Have you seen and the Rough Stuff Fellowship, the archive book? Yeah, like, those guys are all gravel riders on like old steel frame touring bikes.
And they were brewing up cups of tea at the top of mountains.
And 21mm tyres.
And like, you know,
they were mountain
like,
biking, basically.
Yeah, wearing like huge tweed jackets that weigh more than bikes do nowadays.
Or the ponchos.
Yeah, ponchos. My mate brought a poncho on one of our bikepacking trips and it was really windy and it literally blew up like a kite.
Like a sail.
He stayed dry and it probably weighed about 2 kilos. So.
Probably sweated on the inside. Yeah.
Like, you know, a lot of people say it in a maybe a negative thing of like, oh, you know, people have been doing it for ages. But this is what's so fun about it now, isn't it? It's like, it is something people have been doing for ages, but these things come in surges and general outdoors lifestyle seems to be quite big at the moment. For whatever reason, maybe it's a reaction against people being stuck on their phones the whole time or watching TV the whole time or like, I don't know, it's a reconnection with nature, but it's a good thing after all, isn't it?
You know what I think a big part of it is? Into the Wild. Have you seen that movie?
Yes.
Oh, I'm reading the book at the moment.
I honestly think that movie had a massive influence on everything adventure at the moment. And like, we probably owe a lot to that movie.
I watched
Have you read
it
the book? It was a John Krakauer book, which I'm reading at the moment. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's a true story. Isn't
it? Yeah.
I watched it when I was at university years ago.
I bet you wanted to quit and just go camping.
No, honestly. We finished watching it at 11 o'clock at night and I was at University of Reading and it had this beautiful lake, really green campus. And we just went out for a midnight picnic because we were like, we can't just go to bed after watching that. Like, I need to change my life. We need to go do something outdoors.
Do you
outdoors.
Feel that was a big influence on you, though, that movie?
Ugh. Part of it, I guess.
I'll tell you a documentary, which I'm eating a walnut at the moment. You'll probably hear me chewing into my. Do you want some?
No, because then I won't be able to talk.
No, all right. Just like greedily eating walnuts while trying to do a podcast.
I do that while trying to sell bikes. So I think your brother movie, Bueller, that had quite a big influence on me because I don't know, there was something about that movie that just really captured, I don't know, a vibe.
Well, it wasn't.
It was kind of, I don't know, it was really laid back and there was some weird music going on.
It was a bit trippy, wasn't it?
It was a bit trippy.
Yeah, it was a bit kind of like weird and trippy and like, I guess there was like no real aimed. I mean, there was an aim to the trip, which was to get to Cape Wrath, but it was just kind of touring and making food and having a laugh and drinking whiskey and. Yeah. A trip that Tom and I both did was the Elan Valley and Cambrian Mountains of Wales.
Yeah.
we were up in the Cambrian Mountains looking for a bothy, which we all had it on GPS Garmins and stuff, and my Garmin died, yours went weird, but it's like raining and dark.
In a farm with some scary dogs, asked a strange farmer which way the bothy was.
So weird. So it was like 10 o'clock at night, it's pitch black, we got to this old farm, the lights were on but no one was answering the doors. Tom then walked around the corner into a barn and there were just two dogs sitting watching the TV.
we heard voices crap around the side and it was two really gnarly looking dogs sat there in the dark listening. I think it was listening to the radio. And I just was like, back up.
And Tom walked out and he was like, no, we don't go in that barn.
Don't go in there.
Don't go in there.
And then we saw lights. This is the most remote area in the UK, I think. There's so few people and houses out there. And we saw at the top of the mountain these lights coming down the hill. Mm. It must have been a good 10 minutes for the car to actually get to us.
Just going down this dirt track, eventually got to us.
Yeah.
And he was like, you've overshot the bothy by like 5 miles.
And he said to us, you need to go back out there about 2 miles and there's some quad bike tracks in the grass on your right. We were like, I don't know how we found that. It
was, then you got a puncture.
Then I got a puncture. Yeah, you guys rode off. It was really windy. They didn't hear me shouting and I had a complete blowout and was in the dark with my head torch trying to punch a plug into my tyre. Yeah.
That was a good trip.
Yeah, it was fun.
Like too fun.
Yeah. Nearly set fire to the place as well. I didn't connect my gas canister properly. Went to light it and the whole thing just blew up in my face. We threw it into the corner of the room, ran into the other room.
I shouted, Tom, throw it out the front door. But he forgot to open the front door, so he just threw it at the door. It bounced back in the room. Ball of fire. It was a ball of fire. We went and hid in the kitchen, like, you know, oh my god, just gonna.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, it was like being in a bunker, wasn't it? Hiding in the other room, just waiting for it to explode.
I was looking for something to smash out the window.
Yeah,
so
you
could climb
out the window. Down. I would have felt really bad about that if we burnt the body down. Seb's gonna lead guys back, so we don't have to move.
Right, should we go to the pub?
Pub, yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. Ooh, a beer's gonna be nice. I have been doing this whole dry Jan thing, but it's been.
No, you haven't.
It's been a bit cold yesterday.
Oh no! It's been kind of failing.
I think it'd be really good to go back to the start of Rudder and where it's conceived. You mentioned before that you started out sort of in the fixed gear scene. Is that what got you into riding?
I mean, I've been into riding on and off my whole life. When I was a teenager, it was, you know, on hardtails building jumps out in the woods. Not that I ever did any particularly big jumps, but mostly just hanging out with mates on bikes in the woods. And then, yeah, actually moving to London and basically not being able to get the tube in rush hour because I was just too claustrophobic, and I found it just, you know, just quite depressing doing that. So bought myself a bike when I was first working in London, and that just kind of got me back into cycling from a practical point of view. And then my brother and I were living together at the time. We've always had loads of harebrained business ideas, and we started buying bikes from the market and like doing them up, and friends would buy them off us, and that's kind of how it happened. Yeah, kind of, we were doing the classic like old school road bike conversion to single speed or fixed gear, and friends would buy them, and that eventually led into us. Vintage bikes became quite expensive, so we just started toying with the idea of designing our own bike and manufacturing one. My brother went on a frame building course with Dave Yates and I learned how to build a frame. So we were maybe thinking about him custom building frames, and that didn't really, it wasn't quite what we wanted, you know. So yeah, so then, you know, our first product was just a classic steel single speed or fixed gear frame, which we weren't even going to brand at the time. We were like, let's just.
What was it called?
It was called the classic steel track frame. We had this like weird thing. So at first, we were buying vintage steel frames on eBay, converting them, building up into simple fixed gear bikes and just selling them to mates. And our initial idea was like, these are now becoming, what we were buying for 50 quid online, suddenly because it was vintage, was £300. And it just didn't, it was over, you know, because it became cool, it became overpriced and it didn't make sense anymore. So we were like, let's just design and manufacture a classic steel track frame, unbranded, and then we can use that to build our bikes and we can sell it on eBay just as a classic frame. But then all the effort that went through designing this and manufacturing it, we were like, actually, we've got to put some sort of brand on it. Do you know what I mean? So Brother Cycles, we came up with the name at a Christmas dinner, and the logo as well, like about a week after that, because the frames were arriving. So it was like a really quick turnaround. And it just kind of went from there. But you know, in the early days, we definitely weren't thinking that we were going to start a bike brand. We were just trying to produce a more affordable option for, you know, getting that classic steel kind of track look, but without having to buy something vintage, which, you know, might be an absolute rust bucket or overpriced, or half the frames would arrive and they were misaligned or damaged, or, you know. So when we first put it on the website, it was the Brother Cycles Classic, I think it was called the classic steel track frame. But it was great because everyone would go on Google and be like, I want a classic steel track frame. And then it was just super lucky. And it, you know, we
rewrote the branding book.
Yeah, we weren't being clever about it. We were actually being really simple and basic about it. It worked pretty well. So yeah, that's how it started.
So you started from very utilitarian, sort of flat inner city, getting people around. How did things evolve from then? Were you going in right at the peak of sort of fixed gear, fanatic?
Yeah. Fixed gear was massive at the time. There were these, Tokyo Fixed Gear was a shop in London at the time, which was just right in the middle of Soho, and it just had a really good community around it. And
there were these groups. I mean, they're still around, but like the guys from the fifth floor were doing these group rides, and there was London Fixed Gear Single Speed Forum, which at the time was kind of booming. Like, there was just so much going on, and it's, you know, it was a way, in a way, we lucked out in that we found a really niche kind of like back entrance into the bike industry, because, you know, it's a very hard industry to get into, but that just happened to be doing well, and we happened to produce a product at the time, and it really just kind of snowballed from there, you know. And it was only as our interest developed, you know, we wanted to use Reynolds steel on the track frame, we wanted to make something a bit lighter and a better product, so we started using different steels, and I started doing longer rides and touring and doing some bigger tours around Europe and up in Scotland. So then we started thinking about maybe doing, you know, a touring bike, which when the Kepler came into it. But the Kepler at the time, we didn't know whether it would be a touring bike or is it a cyclocross bike. And then we were like, well, maybe let's do a kind of touring bike that could be kind of suitable to cyclocross. And then that ended up just being a gravel bike, basically, which happened
before gravel was invented.
In a way, yeah. As it was such. Like it, you know, and it was Canty braked, so it's kind of had this kind of retro feel to it. And yeah, you know, again, it was just us literally making products that we wanted ourselves, not necessarily thinking we'd sell lots of them. But it was very much a hobby business. We had full-time jobs at the time, but it just, as we produced more products and as the demand grew, we just kind of put the money we made back into making different products or developing products or expanding the product range, and yeah.
So that all sort of came about, was it around the time of the 2012 Olympics, sort of people getting much more into cycling as a nation?
Yeah.
A lot of hype around road cycling, the track team.
Yeah, I think so. Like, you know, roads, you know, London was booming after the Olympics, and it seemed like, you know, we were at that time, we were selling most of our stock into London, and bike, you know, little independent bike shops were popping up all over the place, and so we definitely were riding that kind of wave, which was great. Sadly, London's kind of become a bit of a different place now, and actually I think independent bike shops are really, a few are doing really well, but a lot of the shops we worked with back then have kind of shut down or changed or moved on. But definitely there was lots of things aligned, you know, the fixed gear world, the gravel scene, the Olympics. It all just happened that as we were doing what we were doing, there was just maybe a slightly abnormally high demand for it, which allowed us to kind of create a brand without, you know, we didn't have any financial backing, or we didn't have any, you know, investors or anything like that at the time. We were just doing small runs of products and people would buy them, and then you just order more of them, and anything you made you would use to develop new products. And so yeah, I think it was a good time to try and start a bike brand, basically.
Where did you see the need to develop the Kepler, a touring bike or something that could do a bit more off-road?
I mean, we were, as I think lots of people who were into cycling at that time in the fixed gear scene, we were just doing longer and longer rides on our bikes, and it was just, I think, getting to the silly point where it was, you know, just brakeless, you know, fixed gear bikes, like just kind of like with huge backpacks on, just, you know, these massive courier bags that weighed about a ton before you even had anything in them. And it was I really enjoyed all that, but it just got to the point of being like, it was literally us. It was kind of the first Kepler we did, we wanted to do something which had a bit of a 90s mountain bike feel, and so we did the kind of crazy fade on it, and it was Canty, you know, made basically for Canty brakes.
What year did the first Kepler come out?
You're testing my, I reckon it would have been 2014 maybe, something like that, maybe 14, 15, so it's quite kind of, yeah, it was kind
quite
of
early in the gravel thing. Really.
It was, but it wasn't a gravel bike. It started off as a cyclocross bike, and then actually I was doing a lot of bike touring at the time, so we're like, let's give it a slightly slacker geometry so you can fit some, you know, you can load it up and do a tour on it. But it had the kind of clearances for slightly knobblier cyclocross tires. So in a way, that is, if you think about what gravel cycling is, it's like a touring cyclocross bike in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So we started doing gravel bikes not because we wanted a gravel bike, because we wanted to do long distance
loaded off-road rides, which is what gravel cycling is, I suppose. But it just came about from a designing a product for what we wanted to do rather than to try and get into a niche, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Was it the Kepler that you took to do Beulah? Was that on...
Mm-mm. So
that was a lot later.
After the Kepler, I then got this obsession over doing the Tour Divide. And so we were thinking about what kind of, you know, could you do Tour Divide in the Kepler? And it's like, no, not really. And actually, the idea of the Big Bro came about, which is, it's like the Big Bro is a mountain bike. It's a kind of 29er mountain bike, but it's still very much gravel orientated. You know, it's a bike which is designed to do things like the Tour Divide. So more technical trails, you know, a bit of single track, but still loaded up with all your kit on it, and you're still, you know, very much, you know, these long distance endurance kind of self-supported races like the Tour Divide, or, you know, even like Tuscany Trail, or all these kind of things.
So for anyone who wouldn't know, how would you describe the Tour Divide as something that you've ridden yourself?
Tour Divide is like an ultra long distance self-supported bike packing, I wouldn't even say race, challenge, which goes from Canada down to the Mexican border, so basically north to south across the whole of the USA. And it's one of the really early kind of original bikepacking races. There are quite a few around now, but I think Tour Divide was one of the kind of... In a time when gravel racing and this endurance off-road racing was a much smaller thing, Tour Divide was this funny race where the website was out of date, and it basically, you meet on the second Friday in June in Banff, Canada, and you send an email of intent to let them know you're doing it, but there's no entry fee, there's no finish line. It's just a kind of, you know, and it's much bigger now, and but it's still got that kind of feel about it of being quite kind of unregulated, and so yeah.
As one of the sort of founding gravel, off-road, long-distance events, do you think that's had much of an impact, the Tour Divide, on the sort of gravel, off-road adventure scene as we see it today?
Yeah, I think so. I think it definitely has. It's still seen as being one of the ultimate challenges when it comes to that kind of cycling, and I think documentaries and even just stories or reviews or photo sets of people doing it have been a huge influence on what people are now wanting to do on their bikes. For me personally, it was a massive influence. I watched the documentary dozens and dozens and dozens of times. I enjoy it every single time, and I think there's something if you get a bug about wanting to do it, and it's very hard to shake that. At the start line, I was meeting guys there who it was their sixth, seventh, eighth attempt at doing it, and sometimes you may not be fit enough, sometimes you have a mechanical problem, you get an injury, you have a crash, you have weather. There's so many, it's over 2,000 miles long, so there's so many things that can happen during that distance that, you know, you just turn up and give it a crack.
I guess the landscapes and the variety of terrain is incredibly demanding.
Yes.
Not only on the body, but on your bike, being able to maintain yourself and your equipment for that long.
Yeah, and it's maintaining yourself and your bike through every kind of weather condition you can imagine. There's snow, there's tons of rain, there's mud, and then there's ultra dry deserts and you know, extreme heat, and you have everything down the whole route. And you could do the first half and the second half couldn't be more different. You know, you've got, you know, snow peak capped mountains up in Canada, and you've got deserts in New Mexico, and yeah, I think that's the appeal of it. It's a thing that I find so, like, there's just so many parts of it that I want to see or experience, and I think that's part of the draw to it.
So how did the Tour Divide go for you?
Tour Divide, it's actually quite a funny one, which I've spent 4 years thinking about and answering the question. Ultimately it went about as badly as it could possibly go. 2 days in, got an eye infection I'm not going to be able to remember all the place names, but on one of the main camp spots at the end of day two, so this is about 250 miles in, you camp out at like a woodland cabin up way up. This is quite a remote part of the Canadian mountains at this point. The following day you drop down and actually cross into Montana. And I'd had a really dry eye, and my friend who I was cycling with put some eye drops in at about 3 a.m, but neither of us had had a shower or washed our hands for 2 days. When I woke up in the morning, my eyeball, I basically had pink eye, so my eye was just red and swollen, and I've also got really bad eyesight in one of my eyes, so it was my good eye that had it, so I've only got my bad eye then to ride. So we then had a 90-mile day off-road, well, basically just following the black line of my friend's tyre just to make it into Montana. So I had a series of, like, I went to a medical centre. I then had to go see an eye specialist. And actually, it was amazing. The people you meet on these trails are usually part of the highlights of it. And I went to, you know, in America, like, medical care is, you know, notoriously expensive. I went to go see a proper eye specialist, private, who I saw him, had two consultations. He gave me all sorts of prescriptions, and essentially he sorted my eye out. I had to have steroids drops in it to like get the infection down. But every time we went in, we were like in our bibs, covered in mud, like, you know, with like our bikes outside. And he didn't charge me a penny for the whole thing because he was, you know, so impressed by what we were trying to do. Anyway, had the eye infection, my eye cleared up, we then hit the road again, and then about 3 days later, we were just pushing it quite hard at that point, trying to make up time. Then I've got a knee which gets a bit dodgy, and my knee went. I then walked about 130 kilometres. It was a really hilly section, the uphills were so steep that walking them was not even much slower than riding them. And then I would roll the downhills. So I had about 2.5 days of walking, pushing my bike, rolling the downhills. And then I thought my knee had got a bit better. I rode for another half day, and then I had to scratch after. So I did about 800 miles. But it's a funny one because at the time I was devastated. I was so, even for about 6 months afterwards, I was in a real funk from, I was so wanting to do it. And then actually if I look back on it, it's like I got to ride like 800 miles of the Canadian Rockies and Montana, and like it's such amazing riding. So I think this is what's put me off the competitive racing element of it now. I think it's good to test yourself, but it completely skewed my perception on what was, you know, I couldn't enjoy having done all that because I felt like I needed to ride the full thing to accomplish it. You know what I mean? It was a funny one. So it was one of the best things I've ever done, and it's totally formed me as I am now and my interest in cycling and the way I approach cycling. But it wasn't an easy process to go through, and it's taken quite a long time to kind of think positively about it. But yeah, that's what happened on my Tour Divide.
So the Tour Divide is quite widely regarded as one of the pinnacles of off-road riding in the world. But what sort of advice would you give to somebody who's perhaps a road cyclist or a mountain biker or not a cyclist at all, who's looking at getting into road or off-road riding for the first time?
I guess I would. My initial reaction was going to say, like, don't pick such a huge challenge to do as your, like, first thing to do. Like, I hadn't done any competitive gravel racing or endurance cycling, so it's like I was like, oh, that's the biggest. But then in a way, I don't know, I think actually it's quite hard. For some people it's quite hard to motivate yourself to do something that you've never done before. It's quite hard, you don't just suddenly start going out. So actually maybe picking a challenge, but maybe a slightly more manageable one. But I think it's quite a good thing to do. You know, the UK has actually now got a load of really cool gravel events, and whether they're challenges like Dirty Reaver or Grinduro or something like that, sign up to something, and at least it gives you a target to be like, right, okay, I know that in 6 months I've got to ride 200k off-road. So it will force you to start thinking about what kit you might want and what bike how you want your bike set up to be, and it will encourage you to get out on rides. And yeah, I think that's a really positive way of getting into it.
So this is one for both of you, really. Where do you see this kind of riding, adventure cycling, gravel, off-road, going in the future? And how do you think it will change? Let's start with Tom.
I would like to think that a lot of the guys getting into gravel now are starting to think about bikepacking, because it's a natural, you know, if they haven't camped before and they're into the sort of faster side of riding, they're going to start riding off-road, start seeing all these nice places and start thinking about camping there as well. So yeah, gravel into bikepacking is a sort of a natural transition. I've noticed that with customers in the shop, they'll get a bike capable of riding off-road and then they'll want to camp and load it up and do some longer, you know, multi-day rides. And I see more, like we were talking about earlier, more niches evolving within gravel. So the bikes, there's quite a variety of gravel bikes. There's your sort of bog standard common 700C 42mm tyre, sort of basically road geometry gravel bike. And then there's some, you know, I almost consider some mountain bikes to be gravel bikes, like the Big Bro.
The Big Bro is a gravel bike.
Depends how you build it up. I mean, it's such a loose term, but I see these sort of niches within gravel popping up, which I think is a good thing. Like people that want to race, people that want to ride quickly, people that just want to explore, people that want to bike pack. So dividing up, and whether there's names for those niches within gravel, I don't know. But yeah, I think there's something for everyone, every type of cyclist.
I think it's at a pretty good place at the moment, as Tom says. You know, it gets people out into slightly more remote areas, and it allows people to do a bit of bike packing and bike touring. And I hope it doesn't particularly change a huge amount from how it is at the moment. I think it's a nice kind of niche within cycling. I think a lot of people get a lot from it. And yeah, I hope it doesn't really change. It seems quite healthy at the moment.
Do you find that gravel for some people is a bit of a gateway drug into more technical off-road riding, sort of mountain biking? Have you seen much of that?
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of road cyclists getting into gravel and then wanting mountain bikes because they are getting to really technical terrain and struggling a bit with a gravel bike. And yeah, they tend to want a mountain bike after that. And the types of mountain bikes that we're selling a lot of are steel frame hardtails, because they appeal to gravel cyclists a little bit more. They're durable and they still ride nicely for big rides, but you can take them on more technical terrain, you can load them up bike packing. So yeah, definitely it's opening a lot of people's eyes to mountain biking. And mountain biking has gone so like extreme in, you know, full suspension mountain bikes. You can't really have that much fun on one of those on a regular trail. You have to be somewhere pretty gnarly. So there's definitely a niche for mountain bikes that are, you know, for lighter terrain, bigger day rides, that sort of thing. And it tends to be gravel cyclists moving into that sort of realm.
Could be a gateway drug for the opposite as well.
Yeah.
A mountain biker who normally goes to a trail centre or gets a lift up. Suddenly they're kind of doing slightly longer. I mean, I'm total speculation. I've never met anyone who's like this.
Yeah.
But like maybe they're suddenly doing slightly longer rides, but still able to do some more technical stuff. And maybe it's better for their fitness. Yeah. And, you know,
I know a few guys who are traditionally mountain bikers and there's this sort of rivalry between road cyclists and mountain bikers. Like, oh, I would never be seen on a road bike. Oh, yeah. But a gravel bike is kind of this in between, which is a bit more socially acceptable.
Honestly, yeah. Yeah. Like from an aesthetic point of view, people love big tyres. Whether it's a road bike with big slicks on it, or you know, mountain bikes have suddenly, it's a drop bar bike with massive knobbly tyres. that appeals. That's pretty cool.
There is something particularly good looking about a drop bar big tyre bike. It just looks good.
It's like fat bikes went a little too far for most people.
Yeah.
But yeah,
my brother and I laugh quite a lot because when we started Brother Cycles 10 years ago, it was like, how can we create the tightest possible clearance on a track frame? It's like, I want like a millimetre of clearance. I don't want to see any daylight. Now it's like, how big a clearance can we fit onto a drop bar bike? Yeah, it's like, how can you fit, you know, we want the biggest tyre possible. It's the total opposite end of the spectrum.
And still, you've got no clearance. you've fitted the biggest tire you possibly can into your bike.
It's still the same.
If you ain't rubbing.
What about a message for people who might want to come down to the New Forest, whether they're touring this spring and summer and they wanted to pop into the shop? Like, yeah. is the ride open to all? Can anybody join? What's the best way to get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole idea of our rides is to be inclusive for anyone who wants to just turn up. It's free. You don't need a special bike. I mean, I wouldn't recommend a road bike with skinny tires because you probably just get lots of punches. But any mountain bike, gravel bike, whatever you want to bring, you can come along, drink coffee in the morning, chat, come for a ride, meet other people. The pace, people always ask about the pace because some people are intimidated thinking it would be too quick, but the pace is really to do with who comes. So if it's a really fast group of riders that will turn up, then we'll ride quite quickly. But if there's slower guys in the group, we'll wait at the gate. You know, no one cares if the pace is a little bit slower. Everyone just chats more, and you know, we tend to get a few punches here and there, which gives everyone a break and time to have a breather. So yeah, it's really inclusive. Anyone can turn up, and you can always send us a message on Instagram or Facebook. And we'll also give you good advice on routes. If you wanted to just turn up and ride on your own, we'll give you a good advice on where to go. We were involved with the bikepacking.com route that Cass did. He came to us in the summer and asked for lots of advice on the route, and yeah, we basically gave him the best of the forest, and he did that. So that's if you want a big ride, you can do that. I think it's 62 miles altogether, but you could always do a section of it. So that's a good GPX file that you can download. And I think we're soon to improve our website to give a bit more detail on routes, so people can just go on the website, find a route, download a GPX file, and go from there. But yeah, you're always welcome to pop in the shop, drink coffee, chat about routes, chat about bikes.
Thanks.
Is that a wrap?
I think it's a wrap.
Ah,
yes.
It's a wrap.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Woo.
So basically, if the gravel scene just dies off after this, it's our fault.
It's
we haven't put everyone off.
So that's it from episode one of the Unpaved podcast. Make sure you subscribe, leave us a review, and share this with your friends. And then we'll see you next week when we're going to be up in the dark peak of the Peak District.
Yeah, we're going to be focusing on route planning next week. Don't forget that you can download the route that you've heard today from, what is it called? Our Komoot profile?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can download the route from our Komoot profile.
And if you haven't used Komoot before and you'd like to give it a go, then they've given you the option to have a free region bundle. So we'll put the instructions for that in the show notes. It's super easy. You just have to make an account and enter the voucher code UNPAVED, all in capitals. And another thing to mention whilst we're talking about free stuff is that we've got a giveaway, again, thanks to Komoot, our sponsor.
So Brother in the Wild, which we've talked about a lot in this podcast, is coming up in May. It's such a good kind of introduction to gravel riding if you've not done that much before, and the whole camping out of music and good food and talks and all sorts. It's a really good weekend, lovely vibes. And if you sign up for the newsletter, you've got a chance of getting a pair of tickets for Brother in the Wild. So sign up, and we'll be announcing the winner of that in the start of March.
Yep.
And next week we're going to be giving you a lot more kind of tips on route planning. So we've got some of the UK's best route planners coming out on a ride with us. You will be able to download that route, and hopefully you'll get some kind of good advice that will make your own route planning a little bit better, or it might just inspire some ideas of places to go. Speaking of places to go, if you have any ideas of good gravel rides or off-road adventures that we can do in the UK, or you know, anywhere, if you want us to come and visit and have got a good way of getting us there, let us know. We want to hear what you think we should cover and what you should talk about, so do get in touch.